puedo hacer
all the good,
todo lo bueno
that the world,
que el mundo
needs,
necesita
that the world,
todo el mundo necesita
needs all the good,
todo lo bueno
that I can do,
que puedo hacer.
Welcome again to World of Immigrants. I'm your host, Angelo Paparelli. Today's podcast will discuss a growing trend in immigration, the subject of the global movement of executives, knowledge workers, and business visitors from country to country. For shorthand, I'll refer to this as global visas. When workers cross one nation's boundaries and enter the sovereign territory of another country, they must do so lawfully. Otherwise, they risk being arrested and roughed up by the immigration police. So what are the trends in today's use of global visas? For background on this topic, be sure to surf over to my blog, www.nationofimmigrators.com. But now, let's explore global visas on World of Immigrants.
Listeners to World of Immigrants, I'm happy today to have for you a leading lawyer in the field of global visas. What's that you say, global visas? What are those? Well, when someone needs to go from country A to country B, and in fact might be a citizen or a legal resident of country C, they need to go through an immigration process. And what we are finding in the post-9/11 world is that the procedures for obtaining these types of visas, which for lack of a better term we'll call global visas, have become increasingly complex. Well, today we have an expert on the subject, Andrea Elliott. Good morning, Andrea. How are you today?
Morning, Angelo. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. How did you get involved in this procedure for global visas?
Thanks for asking, Angelo, and thank you for having me on your show. I originally got involved when I was working in South Africa, which is where I'm from originally. And I was asked by, at that time, I was general counsel to a national insurance company, and I was asked by one of the paralegals who was working there to help her with her husband's immigration. He was Austrian and was trying to immigrate to South Africa. And that's how I fell into the world of immigration.
I hope it's been a happy fall.
It has been. Thank you.
Great. Now tell me, what are some of the trends that you see as people try to gain visas to countries where they may never have visited before for business or pleasure?
Well, some of the trends I see are actually rather disturbing. They are trends that are, I guess, in response to the post-9/11 clampdown of issuance of work permits all over the world. Specifically, I'm referring to the trend of stealth expats, which is where an employee of a firm transferring, for example, to Sweden would go in on a business visa and ostensibly be conducting business when, in fact, they are actually working and conducting employment. And that's one of the more disturbing trends that I have seen. The other trend that I've seen is the increase in strict scrutiny all over the world as a direct response to 9/11, also to 3/11, and then now again to the French, to the London bombings. And specifically here I'm thinking of France, which has just revised its stance on the Schengen Treaty, which meant that if you were an EU citizen, for example, you could cross the borders anywhere in Europe without having any passport controls. And as of a few days ago, France has just cancelled that privilege, and you're now required to go through passport controls again.
So if I understand it correctly, though, members of the European Union can still travel freely. They just must present a passport
Yes.
and be inspected.
Yes, as opposed to being able to just travel without any type of inspection at all.
And what was the procedure before? Just a identification by voice of
Nothing.
Their nationality?
No, because the European Union is made up of 25 member states, there was a treaty that was formed in 1985 in Luxembourg in this little town called Schengen. And there the original seven member states agreed to form a communal internal and external border policy. And what that meant was that if you arrived at one of the seven member states, let's say, for example, France, you arrived at their international border post with your passport, you would be checked once at an external border. you would then be free to move about the Schengen territories without any additional internal border checks. So you could move from France to Spain, from Spain to Portugal, and vice versa without any additional checks. As a direct result of the London bombings, France has removed that privilege. So you now can no longer travel freely internally. In other words, if you were coming from Spain into France, you would now have to be checked.
I see. Now, you talked about that first disturbing trend. Can you elaborate on that one as well?
Absolutely. Stealth expats is something that I've seen growing in increasing numbers over the past 5 years.
What is a stealth expat exactly?
Great question. Well, the noun stealth refers to the concept of undercover, like a stealth missile,
yes.
Something that can't be detected. Now, an expatriate who is termed a stealth expatriate is somebody who's flying under the legal radar, under the immigration radar, per se.
And doing what when they arrive?
They're arriving on, if you use the U.S. as an example, somebody who would be coming in on a B-1 visa, but would in fact be performing the functions of an H-1B worker.
Let's, for the audience's sake, a B-1 is a business visitor, and the H-1B is a worker in a specialty occupation who must go through a much greater scrutiny in order to come into the country and must be pre-approved with an employer's sponsorship and labor protections that are associated with working in the United States. Unlike the business visitor, which is just to allow for attendance at meetings and conferences and engage in other permitted activities that do not constitute employment. So in other words, they're coming into the United States claiming to be on business, and then instead they are engaging in work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happening in other countries as well?
Yes, that's exactly the same trend that you're seeing in other countries.
And how are the countries generally dealing with this if they discover it?
The laws, in fact, for example, the United Kingdom has just recently tabled a bill in Parliament to amend its provisions of its formerly very lax, for want of a better description, immigration bill, and it's now provided for spot fines for employers who employ illegal workers, as well as deportation for the actual offending employee.
I see, and I suppose there will be the attendant negative publicity in the local and perhaps the national or international press.
Absolutely, and I think one of the common myths that is apparent in the larger firms is that, well, we're XYZ, so nothing's going to happen to us. Well, look how much money we invest in this government, when in fact the opposite is in fact true. The sentiment should rather be the larger they are, the harder they'll fall, and they'll be made a public example of.
Do you think it's possibly a recognition that after September 11th, the burdens of international travel are such that there can be delays and business meetings may go missed, or other contractual deals will fall through the hands of someone who is trying to secure a sale if they comply with the more time-consuming employment-based visas?
I think that's certainly a fair comment, but it certainly doesn't negate the fact that good planning always helps. But it's always the first requirement should always be to obey the law. And there are the definitions of business in Europe especially are much more friendly than they are in other parts of the world. In other words, there's a much broader discretion offered. So there is a lot that you can do. But what I'm seeing is that a lot of people are really pushing the boundaries in terms of the definition of what they consider work. As an example, when somebody packs up their domestic household, moves their children out of their schools in their home country, places them in their school in the foreign country, and sits in a foreign country for a year, I think the assumption is that that's no longer a business trip, certainly not one that I've ever been on.
Nor I. You mentioned this in Europe. What about Asia and other parts of the world? How are immigration violations treated in those countries? Is it worse than a spot fine?
Yes. Let's use specific examples. In Hong Kong, for example, the Hong Kong Immigration Department is very proud of its record for prosecutions of illegal employment. In addition, the fines are far higher. Now, we were talking about the fine in the UK, where we're talking about perhaps a $5,000 fine. In Hong Kong, you're talking about a $350,000 fine.
I see.
Which is a significant penalty for simply not wanting to get a work visa.
And is that for as few as one employee?
That's for as few as one employee.
I see. Now tell me, in terms of security clearances, are the countries of the world taking the lead from the United States, where we have far more intensive security clearances than we did before 9/11?
They are, although they are not, they're not doing it with the same amount of gusto that we do. They, in certain countries, they have similar items, such as the special registration, which of course you can explain shortly to the listeners. For example, in Germany, they have what's known as an anti-terrorist interview, which is also, if you are from certain designated countries, you're required to appear in person at the visa office for this anti-terrorist interview.
Well, the special registration, for the audience's sake, is something that came up a few years ago in response to 9/11, and it targeted mostly male entrants and residents in the United States from certain Middle Eastern countries or some Islamic countries. It created quite a stir because it appeared to be an unsuccessful effort at catching terrorists, but a successful effort at catching small-scale violators of the immigration laws who had already begun to establish family ties, business ties, and roots in the United States. And ultimately, the government backed down on it, but has come back with a new system known as U.S. Visit, which has many aspects, but basically controls the entry and records the departure of all non-immigrants who come to the United States. And we are seeing with that a requirement both in the countries that are exempt in terms of their nationals coming here from a visa requirement. They can just present their passport as proof of their nationality and come for a 90-day period. But now there will be certain machine-readable requirements and soon biometric readable requirements associated with passports. Are you seeing those kinds of trends as well, Andrea?
Yes, I am, actually. In fact, if you think about the imposition of biometrics, if we just use that as an example.
Maybe you can define what you mean by biometrics, because
right,
I'm not sure everyone knows that.
Let's explain what we mean. When we're talking about biometrics, we're talking about identifiers that are unique to the person. For example, an iris scan, that would be having your sticking your eye up against a scanner and having the iris scanned. No one iris is the same, so it would be as unique as a fingerprint, which brings me to the next example, which is a fingerprint. That's also known as a biometric identifier. There's also new technology called facial recognition technology, which they are introducing. So all of these tools are used, and not only by governments, but if we think about where they originate from, they actually originate from the aviation industry. And they are as a result of treaties with the civil aviation authorities all over the world that require the same type of identification the world over.
So would it be wise for people to begin to apply early for the newest form of passport available from their particular country of nationality?
Yes, that would be really practical advice.
And what about these so-called trusted traveler procedures? I understand the United States allows people to go through airport lines more quickly if they voluntarily submit and pay a registration fee for the opportunity to have their personal backgrounds reviewed and checked against governmental databases. Is that happening in other countries of the world?
Yes. In fact, in this instance, the U.S. is following the lead of the rest of the world as opposed to leading the pack. This, for example, in Malaysia has been an offering for many years with a simple card, a swipe of a card you go through, much like the one that you're describing right now.
So it appears that governments around the world are amassing huge amounts of data and using data mining techniques to identify patterns of potential terrorist or criminal behavior. And yet, my understanding is that in the United States, privacy is more a matter of protections in the commercial area where your information is used by mortgage companies and banks and retailers, as compared to the concept in Europe where privacy is clearly a personal right that is virtually inalienable. What would you say are some of the concerns when you prepare these kinds of applications, and many of which ask for very, very private historical information or biographical information about individuals?
That's also a very good question, Angela. It's one of the fundamental differences right now with the dealings for immigration globally versus dealings for immigration in the U.S. The European specifically and Asia actually now are governed by the Data Protection or the Data Privacy Act, which is a European Union fundamental concept, which as you rightly stated means that privacy is an inalienable right of the person who is giving the data. So what are the concerns from an immigration perspective are, A, that you have to have consent in order to receive and transmit that particular data. You have to be very specific about who the data is going to be going to, so that if you're collecting the information, for example, with a passport number, and things as innocuous to certainly to Americans as your gender need to be collected, we have to make sure that we have permission to collect it. We have to state the purpose that we're collecting it for. And then we also have to have safe harbor principles in place whereby we have somebody who is appointed to manage the data, and that if anybody wants access to the data, in other words, the person who's provided the access, was provided the data, wants access, they have the right to access it and or to change it. So there are key differences with the way that information has to be handled coming from and to the European Union and Asia.
My understanding is that despite legislation that was passed in the United States several months ago now, the president has not yet appointed a director for the Office of Civil Rights and Privacy, because this is increasingly a concern. We are seeing the beginnings of a debate about whether all American citizens must have a national identity card.
Mm-hmm.
And at present, the driver's licenses are sort of a proxy for a national ID card coupled with social security numbers or social security cards. In countries of the rest of the world, is there a big concern about having to carry a national identity card or domestic passport?
Paradoxically, the answer is no. When you think about the Data Privacy Act that emerged from Europe, in fact, with those very strict provisos, Europeans have for years, many, many years, been carrying what's known as an identity card and or a residence card, which serves as their primary form of identification. There never has been any large outcry about having to do it simply because it's always been done. I don't think people have ever actually stopped and thought whether or not they should be carrying it is an issue or an invasion of their privacy. They've simply accepted that that's what one has to do.
And it's also interesting that routinely in foreign countries, hotels ask for passports and oftentimes share the information with their local police agencies, which exercise immigration powers within many foreign countries. And that would be unheard of in the United States. So on the one hand, we are perhaps behind the rest of the world in the protection of our privacy interests, but ahead of them in being able to go about at least freely within the country up to the present. Let's talk about the advice you might give to a company or a business executive or a traveler traveling on family matters who wants to go to a country where a visa is required for entry. How do they find out about the requirements? How do they choose a provider? Are the providers licensed in any way? What would you recommend to them?
Well, the first thing I would do is break the fundamental belief that people have that it's a visa that's required. If we can, just split hairs semantically and say that a work permit is what's always needed for work authorization, and a visa is required for entry. So if I was advising a corporation and or their employer who would be traveling for work purposes, I would be advising them to get a work permit and a visa to enter the country. If it was a person who was traveling on family matters, then they would be requiring only a visa for entry. So there would be a difference in what I would be advising. But let's look at the question that you asked. In other words, where would they get the information? If it was a person who was traveling on family matters, they would be able simply to use the internet as a very rich resource to find out the consulate of destination in their area of jurisdiction and establish what the visa requirements were for their particular needs.
So they would do it in their home country and just look up the internet to find the embassy or consular post that has authority over the state or province where they live.
Correct.
Okay.
That's exactly what they would do. On the other hand, if they were going to be going for work purposes, then the procedure that you described previously in our discussion about the H-1B, where you'd have to get prior work authorization from the host country's labor authorities, would be required. And for that, you need to have a lawyer involved. And people ask me often, why is it that I need to have a lawyer? You know, isn't it just filling in forms? And the answer is, if it was just filling in forms, I wouldn't have been busy for the last 19 years. The answer is because it's the practice of law. These are immigration laws that are written. These are citizenship laws. They're employment and labor laws, which by definition require the interpretation of a lawyer.
Well, are there some countries that allow other specialists to render these services and where they also allow lawyers to do it?
The answer to that question is yes. But I think you've also hit the nail on the head when you use the word specialist. By definition, people, and if I think of it offhand, I'm thinking of Australia, where you're allowed to be a migration expert. You have to pass very stringent exams in order to be qualified as a migration specialist, which I would have no problem referring somebody to since they were experts in their field.
Well, Andrea, you've put 19 years into this, but you couldn't possibly be expected to know the ins and outs of immigration law in every one of the major countries of the world. How do you keep up?
I sleep an hour at night.
I see. And aside from your restricted sleep schedule, could you explain what people can do to find a qualified expert?
Absolutely. If a firm, for example, was looking for a qualified expert, historically, what the bigger firms did, the Fortune 500s, for example, is they used to go to their big four accounting firms. But with the advent of Sarbanes-Oxley, the act that requires a separation of consulting services and accounting services, more of the firms have been looking for specialist firms / specialist law firms to offer them the service. So my immediate advice would be to ask if you were in human resources or in the legal department of a firm who was looking for this type of services, go to your local human resource organizations, see if they have any referrals for you. Again, use the internet as a superb resource. Use the Google or Yahoo search engines for global visa services or immigration services. That would be one of the ways that you could go and do it. The other way, of course, is you could go and look at the local bar, the bar listings, and look up by specialty and see whether or not you find anybody that suits the requirements and the country requirements that you have. Of course, a lot of that is hit and miss. You could certainly look up somebody, but whether or not you were able to find out who they were, what their specialties were, whether they were still currently licensed, whether they were what you wanted, that's a whole other exercise. And for that, you really need to have a specialist firm involved.
And the act of deciding who does what portion of the work, I mean, it seems to me there's a certain measure of routine effort to gather factual information, addresses, dates of birth, dates of marriage. And then there is the question of knowing what work permit category to select, the processing time, the amount of effort in terms of visits to an immigration office, or whether it's done by mail or messenger service. How is that divided up between a company and the local provider?
There are two answers to that question, really. One is, there are certain countries where you can actually prepare everything apart from just factual data collection. You can actually make the visas category selection and prepare the forms and support documents and submit all of those directly by mail. You can e-file in certain countries by fax or hand over to a local agent simply for filing purposes. And those are in the countries where you generally find the immigration traffic is highest. In other words, the top 20 countries, for example, that people are routinely going to, when you've been doing it for as long as I have, and for example, as long as you have in U.S. immigration, those things come naturally eventually. But in the countries, for example, where there's not a huge destination traffic, like Azerbaijan, for example, in that instance, you would ensure that really you were the pivotal point for the person who was making the transfer in terms of the data and factual gathering. But then as far as the visa category selection, that would come as a result of a joint discussion, A, you having heard the client's needs, but B, then translating it into a language, apart from Azerbaijani, but translating it into a language that the co-counsel in the foreign country can understand.
Now, it seems to me that in many countries of the world, at least it's been my experience, the specialty area of law known as immigration is not as well developed as, say, perhaps in Britain, South Africa, Canada, and the United States and Australia, those main countries. So how do you know if a lawyer truly is experienced in the area, and also whether there is, I think there's maybe a popular perception that in some countries a greasing of palms is required.
Right, and that's a very good question, because in many countries that is in fact assumed to be the norm. And what you really have to do, as certainly what I find in my practice, is that I act as the translator, for want of a better description. In other words, saying if I represent a large Fortune 500 company that has very specific compliance policies, and I know that the cultural expectation on the other side is that if you pay an extra $500, it'll be done on the first day, my job is to then explain that the $500 will not be forthcoming, and it is because this company has very strict compliance requirements, and this is not how the company does business, so it has to be done the regular way. And if that takes longer, it takes longer.
And it seems then that when you talk about your role as translator, is that an area or a service that is growing in demand? Have you seen any uptick in the demand for these kinds of intermediary services? I like to think of it as a kind of Sherpa who guides the large organizations and some of the emerging companies over the mountains and other obstacles of global visas.
I think that's a great description. The answer is yes. As you find more and more companies are realizing that the village that they call the world is in fact just that, a global village, and that so many more firms are using outsourcing of services as a trend, they are having to send managers and or people in the know to these locations where they have outsourced services to make sure that all is well, and so require services that they never previously had to require, such as global visa services. So the answer is yes. I'm finding, while I would say that the rate of people being sent on assignments per se hasn't changed, it's still very steady. People going abroad to do work for, in foreign countries, definitely as companies are emerging and discovering that they need these services, they absolutely are looking for someone who can just make sense of it to them. And it's not only in the U.S. I think it's important to note that countries like India, for example, who are now emerging as sleeping giants in terms of labor providers and technology services providers, they themselves are also entering the international arena and also have no resources and no idea of where to go and who to look to, just for basic or fundamental information like, you know, what is the factual data I need to gather in order to do a work permit, or what's the difference between a work permit and a visa, and that kind of level of resource, there just isn't out there for them.
Are you seeing any trends toward the standardization of information that's being requested, or demands for minimum service levels in terms of efficiency, case management, delivery of the finished product?
I think the answer to that is yes. As people become much more knowledgeable consumers of immigration services, certainly from a provider's perspective, we're absolutely always looking for products that increase efficiencies. But as to standardization of documents, would that it was like that. It would certainly make my life much easier. The answer is no. Often it's really on the whimsy of the consular location that you're dealing with, that you could be dealing with one country that has one requirement. In fact, a country that has, you would think, a set of requirements, whereas in fact one consulate will view it as such and a consulate in a different jurisdiction will view it entirely differently.
Well, it's not unlike the manner of getting permanent residence or the so-called green card in the United States. One can do it within the United States and you deal with one agency, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, one can apply for an immigrant visa, and you deal with the Department of State, and then at the airport, you deal with another agency, the Bureau of Customs and Border Protection. So it's not unusual, I would suspect, and please confirm if I'm right or wrong, that even under the same body of national law, a country may have two or perhaps three different ways to secure an equivalent benefit, one which may be less burdensome than another.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Now, why is it necessary, though, to engage in advanced planning? You mentioned that before. If you can go into a country under a visa waiver mechanism, why can't you just go into the country and then sort it out once you're there?
You see, if we could vote for you for president, that would make it our lives much easier.
I'm not running, and
if
drafted, I will not serve.
Well, the answer to that is there are a few countries who do offer that wonderful opportunity for you to go in, not on a waiver program, but typically on a business visa, and then switch your status. But those countries are very far and few between, and of the some 190 countries in the world, I think I can only think of three offhand that offer you that opportunity.
And what are those three, just out of curiosity?
Chile would be the one. Chile would be the first one.
Must be a lot of demand for that.
Yes, and I have hordes of people lining up to go to Chile. The other one is actually the UK.
I see.
Now, let's just think about why forward planning is so important. Well, I think a lot of it boils down to the fact that a company needs to decide where this critical decision-making process rests and support that business unit and or that human resource unit who makes that decision. Too often we find that the human resources centers that deal with this are often the last people to find out that in fact a person is traveling, but the business unit managers made a decision that they need Mr. XYZ tomorrow and they will do whatever it takes to get Mr. XYZ to get there. I think what needs to happen is that the stakeholders in the process need to be educated as to the benefits of doing things correctly and of doing some advanced planning in terms of their labor requirements.
And also I think of the consequences of rash action that may not be in full compliance with local immigration law in the country of destination.
Absolutely. The last thing you want to do is have somebody who's excited about their new position, they're looking forward to working on this new project, and they get deported. There can be nothing worse in terms of their perception of the company, in the damage that it does to the project and the damage that it does to the morale of the people at the destination. It's just not worth it when you think that it costs you maybe between $2,500 and $4,000 to get it done properly the first time.
I hate when that happens. Well, Andrea, do you have any closing thoughts for our audience?
Just to say that this is a difficult area of law, and there is a really good survey out there if any of your listeners want to go and have a look. And I'm not employed by Ernst & Young, but I can definitely recommend that people take a look at their Global Immigration Survey, which talks about the difficulties that people encounter when dealing with staff mobility globally. Very interesting survey.
Andrea, I suspect that you might have a website where people can gather information as well.
I do indeed, Angelo. Thanks very much.
Would you provide it to us?
Sure. That would be www.pro-link-global.com.
Okay. And did you really mean dash or did you mean hyphen?
I meant hyphen.
Okay. people put in two hyphens and they won't get to you, but put in one and they'll get to you.
That's right.
And I thank you very much for today's participation, and we'll look forward to our next edition of World of Immigrants.